to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, Brits, Amazon, Tony Basil. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
How are you?
I am good.
Are you?
Although I seem to have developed a cough. Weirdly, since getting off the tube at Liverpool Street Station, I've not had a cough all week. In fact, I've not been doing much talking this week. In recent weeks, I've been like talking every day at events and training seminars and all of that stuff. But this week, other than the CMU seminar, which we do every Monday evening, oh, and the Urban Development Industry Takeover seminar on Tuesday night, I've been doing a bit of speaking this week, but a lot less than normal. But I haven't had a cough all week. I got off the tube to come to the studio and suddenly I started having a coughing fit.
Well, that bodes well for getting this podcast recorded quickly.
It does. We do need to try and get this podcast recorded quite quickly. So if it ends up being incredibly short, what you will know is we did record for about 45, 50 minutes, but there was 40 minutes of coughing once that was edited out. We'll just leave it in. What would
be
worse?
But my favourite record at the moment I'm listening to is an opera based on things in Fugazi shows between the songs. So talking and like tuning instruments.
Oh.
So it'd be a bit like that, just with coughing.
Well, what would be worse, a really, really short podcast, like 8 minutes, or a normal 40, 50-minute podcast of which 40 minutes was just me coughing? Which would be more embarrassing to deliver to our listeners?
Well, we'll just have to wait and see which version they get.
I'm going to drink some water, and I'm sure it'll be fine.
Well, anyway, coming up this week, we've got Amazon giving up its ticketing ambitions, perhaps, and hurdles for Tony Basil in her legal battle with Disney. But first, it was the Brits last week.
It was indeed. And in recent years, because we always do a little write-up of the Brit Awards.
We do.
The day after in the CMU Daily. We support the British music industry.
Yeah, we do.
Like that. So we always do a Brits write-up. And I would say for the last 3, maybe 4 years, I've done the Brits write-up.
Yeah.
There was at least one year where you were on holiday on Brits Week. Imagine that, going on holiday in February. I remember that.
I don't.
I do.
I wonder where I went.
But I've normally written up the Brits reports. This year, Andy did it. And yep. The interesting thing is, because neither of us went this year, so neither of us were actually in the O2 Dome there. But because you knew you were writing up the report, you actually watched it.
Yeah.
Which I the 4 years I've written it up, and probably before that, I can't remember before that, I never actually watched it. I just did the write-up. Well, last year, 2017, I was actually running a CMU DIY workshop in Cardiff. Because I remember when someone from the BPI/Brits phoned up saying, do you want to come to the Brits? And I said, I can't. I'm teaching a CMU DIY workshop in Cardiff. And they were like, oh, it's a real shame. And it's like, I would much rather be upstairs in a pub in Cardiff with 10 really enthusiastic artists discussing whatever it was we were discussing that week than going to the O2 for the Brits. It's a big sociable night out for the music industry.
It's not your sort of thing.
I'm not sociable. So, also, I don't drink. And the thing about awards events is that, well, the dinner is always, well, I don't know what it is about awards events, but the food, the portions are always tiny, aren't they? Like just about big enough that they would appear on an Instagram photo if someone bothered to take a photograph, which they probably did last night. Tiny portions. So, like, usually you get, I don't know, 2 bites of chicken, a baby potato, and maybe a carrot. And that's it. But the booze flows from the minute people walk into the door and are handed a glass of champagne all the way through the night.
It's not like the NME Awards where they sort of, you walk in and they hand you like half a slice of bread. And they go, and now here is all the booze you could possibly imagine.
They take it to the extreme, it is true. But most award events, tiny portions of food, a lot of booze. So by the time the award show actually starts, most of the people in the room have been numbed by alcohol.
Yes.
Whereas I'm sitting there stone cold sober. So I'm the person who notices how freaking tedious awards events are and how most pop stars, once they stop singing, are really boring and deliver really tedious speeches. And then they always get, the Brits, because it's an ITV television programme, basically. Mm. So they always get kind of celebrities that the ITV viewer, the Coronation Street viewer who's accidentally tuned in, might recognise doing the actual presentation. And I never know who they are. So it's, I mean, obviously the music performances can be entertaining. The Mercurys, when the Mercury Prize used to get everybody to perform, do they still do that? They kind of downsized the Mercury Prize. It might have gone, I've not been invited for a few years, possibly because of the time when all I did in my write-up was moan about the fish. Because I don't eat fish, and that was the only non-vegetarian option. Anyway, I digress. The Mercury Prize was good when every single nominated artist does a performance. And they were just one after the other, because it used to be that they had like two or three stages. So literally, there would be performance, performance, performance. And actually, that was quite good. Although it was a bit weird watching basically a gig while sitting at a dining room table, waiting for the food to come out. But that's enjoyable. But most awards events are quite tedious. So therefore, I've not really watched the Brits, despite writing up reports on it. In fact, one of the years I wrote up, I was a year I was there. But it was the year that there was the whole MasterCard thing. Do you remember that?
Yes. When you weren't allowed to disparage the sponsor.
A journalist had sent out an email that some PR agency had sent them, hadn't they, saying, we're happy to have you at the Brit Awards. It wasn't you couldn't be disparaging about the sponsor MasterCard. It was that you had to make sure you mentioned MasterCard
in your
write-up. Oh, that was
it. Yeah, yeah.
And so,
and your tweet and anything had to be hashtagged MasterCard.
So all the coverage on the day of the event was just people writing about this and mocking both MasterCard and the PR agency for it. I don't think that PR agency has worked on the Brits since. And so basically, even though I was at the awards, so could have written it up having watched it, I just mocked the whole MasterCard thing throughout the entire article. Anyway, it's a very long-winded way of saying it. Andy Malt did his research. And he actually sat down in front of ITV1 and watched the Brit Awards.
It was weird. I don't watch live TV ever at all. And
but you clearly have the technology.
I have the technology.
I don't have the technology anymore.
But I don't do that. And it was really weird watching something with adverts. And I'm not sure if this probably was always like this, but it did seem like there were adverts every 2 minutes.
As the years go by, I think commercial TV has increased the number of ads, both in terms of how frequently the breaks come, and also how many ads they're allowed per hour, I think, has increased. And probably, I mean, compared to Coronation Street, the Brit Awards isn't that big an audience. But it probably has a fairly sizable audience. So probably quite a lot of people want to advertise during the Brits. So from ITV's perspective, and they're putting a load of money into screening the show, so whatever, they want to squeeze in as many ads as possible. So there was as much advertising to watch as there was performances and awards being given. Is that what it felt like?
It certainly felt like that, yeah.
What was the standout ad?
The standout ad was the one that was advertising one show for Queen at the O2, which seemed like, it didn't seem like a good use of their money.
That does seem a bit extravagant, doesn't it?
One gig.
Are they only doing, because obviously they announced this because Queen, Adam Lambert are doing another trek, but are they only doing one date at the O2?
Yeah.
It was a TV ad to advertise
one show. Yeah.
Wow. Do you think because,
I mean, surely that's just wiped out any profit they might make.
Unless,
I mean, maybe the O2 gets a discount.
Well, exactly, because the Brits is at the O2. So do you think they say to the ITV people, oh, we'll give you this special nice room for your staff if you give us a special rate or something. But then the O2 aren't putting on the show, are they? I mean, there's a promoter putting on the show. I don't know. Don't understand how TV advertising works. But anyway, we're not here to talk about the ads. This isn't the Super Bowl. This is the Brit Awards. So tell us what happened at the Brit Awards 2018.
Well, lots of things happened at the Brit Awards 2018. What do you specifically want to know about?
Well, I suppose, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on Setlist, obviously the Brits always follows the Grammys.
Yes.
A couple of weeks later. And this year's Grammys were pretty much totally dominated around the debate about the utter lack of gender diversity. Yes. At this year's show. So in terms of the actual televised part of the Grammys, because the Grammys dish out so many awards each year, that the bit that's actually shown on telly is only sort of the big awards. And of the awards that were actually presented during the show, only one went to a woman.
Yes.
And then of the performances, they were very male-dominated too. So that was the big talking point around the Grammys. And then, of course, the boss of the Recording Academy, which owns the Grammys, then made some stupid remarks,
yeah,
which they're still backtracking on 2 weeks later. So I think what we said when we talked about the whole Grammys debacle a couple of weeks ago was it would be interesting to see whether or not the Brits had a bit more gender diversity and whether that was a conversation around this event as much as it had been with America's big awards bash.
Well, it was better than the Grammys. That's, I mean, it's a low benchmark, but it is true that it was better than the Grammys. It did seem like after the Grammys that the Brits sort of panicked a bit and tried to do things to preempt any sort of backlash or criticism. But still, the performers and awards winners skewed significantly male. The awards givers were actually in the main women, although I mean, I suppose those are the people you can change at the last minute more easily, or just add more people to come on stage.
Yeah, because sometimes they have two or three or five people.
Yeah, so that's a really easy way to bump up your diversity, and they did. It was definitely a more diverse group of people presenting awards than perhaps performing their music throughout the show. Jack Whitehall at one point claimed that it was probably the most diverse award show ever. I'm not sure what he was basing that on.
So he was the host. We've not said that.
No, he was the host. He also, quite late in the day, made a scripted dig at himself for being a white man. And there was sort of an official, I think we talked about this last week, the Brits was officially supporting the Time's Up campaign and inviting people to wear white rose pins in solidarity with that campaign. And there was a lot of white roses on the stage, people wearing actual roses or these pins.
And I suppose that was taking what was an unofficial campaign at the Grammys and making it officially endorsed by the Brits organisers at the Brits.
Yes, and they had sort of an official section of the show where before Lorde was presented with the Best International Female Prize, they had Ellie Goulding and Adjoa Abdur come on and sort of talk about the White Roses and talk that up. And Ellie Goulding referenced the comments made by the Grammys boss, Neil Portnow, about women needing to step up. She said women have been stepping up for years, but it, I don't know, it all felt a bit lacklustre. Actually, the biggest moment for that was Dua Lipa won best, it was the first award of the evening, actually, the best British solo female. And she gave a speech kind of saying, thanks to all the women who've been on this stage before me and for inspiring me and others to kind of work to achieve like making music and winning awards. And then she did a performance where she had like 40 female dancers. That wasn't kind of an official thing done by the ceremony, but it really felt like that was the moment that people talked about in terms of like Me Too and Time's Up. This is empowerment. This is feminism in action. And
I mean, her performance is officially part of the
show. It is officially part of the show, but it's not part of the show that's been designed necessarily by the organisers of the Brits, is what I mean. Whereas pushing Ellie Goulding on to say women are all stepping up already, that is something that they've gone, right, we need someone to say that. So that's where I'm splitting those two things.
So that was the gender diversity conversation. Now, of course, 2 years ago at the Brits, and then I think last year at the Grammys, the diversity conversation was more about ethnic diversity and genre diversity than it was gender diversity. And there was that year where Grime had just had a big 12 months, and then the following year's Brits made no reference to that whatsoever. And so there was a bit of a hoo-ha saying, well, that's a bit embarrassing that we're overlooking this really exciting, vibrant genre. And the Brits, to be fair, responded to that. They rejigged the Academy who actually vote so that they have a more diverse group of people voting. The idea being, we talked about this on Setlist a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? That by having a more diverse Academy, those people are going to be more aware of a greater range of genres. And then I think last year's Brits was generally accepted to be a little bit better in terms of ethnic and genre diversity in terms of the people who performed. But it was only really this year that it was actually reflected in the winners, in that one of the double winners of the night was Stormzy.
Yeah, he was the big winner of the night because he won two awards, including the Best Album, which is the last award of the night. And then he was the headline performer. And he gave certainly, I think, well, Kendrick Lamar was sort of hobbled a bit.
But more than that in a moment.
But he definitely gave the standout performance of the night. His album, Gang Signs and Prayer, which won the Best Album, is an album of two halves, sort of grime and gospel. And so he started with a bit of gospel, and he went on to a bit of grime. And in the middle, he did a bit of an attack on Theresa May, which is always fun. And there were a few political moments in the show, but that was the most really pointed and one that really hit its target.
Yeah, so as someone who didn't actually watch the Brits this year, so I saw a few things going on Twitter and Facebook. you were commentating to me live on Slack. So I had a combination of what was happening on the social networks over here and what you were saying on Slack over here. One person suggested that we should just publish our Slack conversation.
Yeah, I considered that and I went back and I'm not sure that would be a good idea. Some of the things I said were not for publication.
But what I would say is you sort of sense that Stormzy kind of stole the show.
Yes.
You mentioned the Kendrick Lamar performance. So I suppose in terms of international acts, I mean, they wheeled on Justin Timberlake at the start, just to confirm once and for all that nobody cares about Justin Timberlake anymore, because that needed to be confirmed, apparently. But I suppose in terms of international acts, Kendrick Lamar was one of the big acts, although by you watching it at home on ITV rather than being in the room, you experienced what the public experienced, yeah. Which was another standout Brit performance screwed up by the ITV censors.
Yeah, it was mostly silence, because I can only assume that Kendrick Lamar swore in his performance, which I think they probably could have guessed would happen, could have checked the lyrics before he went on, before they put him in the 10 p.m. slot, where, like, well, I guess you suggested that they would be a bit edgy around then because people would be turning on expecting the 10 o'clock news.
Well, I'm not even sure ITV's news is usually on at 10 o'clock.
I don't know.
But possibly.
I don't watch live TV, as I said, so I don't know when the news is on anymore. It's on when I tell it it's on. But yeah, it was like that Kanye West performance from a few years ago. It was mainly just the sound cut out, so you couldn't hear it. Which is just really annoying. And especially when the show is designed to be a TV show, don't have it set up so that that's going to be a problem in the performance, because you can know in advance that's going to be swearing in the performance.
It's a bit weird, isn't it? I mean, it is an ITV1 show, and ITV's a very mainstream channel, but they must know that. The year that they had the Kanye set, and then that was nearly all silent. They don't even bleep it, do they? They just turn the sound off. So if you were to tune in randomly, you'd be like, oh, the sound's not working.
It says audio muted in the corner, so you know.
So it tells you. But I think the year that they had it with Kanye, he was a last-minute replacement. If I remember rightly, I think Rihanna was meant to be playing, and for some reason that didn't happen. So he was a relatively late addition. So you were sort of like, oh, well, did they just not think it through because it was all a bit last minute? But, I mean, Kendrick Lamar was a early booking for this year's Brit, so you'd think they could have thought that through before it happened. And either say to the artist, really sorry, this goes out on a really mainstream commercial TV channel, can you do a TV-friendly version? And if the artist said, no, I won't, then it's sort of like, well, even though we would really love to have you at the show, perhaps you're not right for this ITV1 television programme that we are involved in. So yeah, that sort of ruined what could have been, and for the people in the room, possibly was one of the standout performances of the night.
Yeah, that was certainly, it was the thing I was really looking forward to and then didn't get to hear.
But there was some car smashing up going
on
at the same time.
Yeah, they had a Lamborghini in a glass box. Yeah, he was performing New Freezer, standing on top of this glass box with a Lamborghini in it. And then the producer of that track, Rich the Kid, was smashing it up with a baseball bat, which is apparently a satire on something.
But you couldn't hear the smashing. That was in a soundproof box or something.
Couldn't hear the smashing, no. You just see it.
There was a show at the Edinburgh Fringe a few years ago where every show they smashed up a car, but they sort of used it as percussion. And it was actually a really good... They turned the smashing up the car into an instrument. But that wasn't... Well, you wouldn't know, would you? Because the sound was down.
No.
But presumably the bits where they weren't muting it out, you couldn't actually hear the smashing of the car. The fact it was happening in a glass box would suggest that that was to soundproof that part of the performance. So those are the people who performed. You've alluded to some of the winners as you talked through that.
Yeah.
Ed Sheeran won the global...
Well done for turning up.
Well, that's the one they introduced a few years ago, didn't they? When One Direction were an absolute high, but then it turned out they weren't going to win any of the awards. So to be absolutely certain One Direction won an award, they did the best global performance, or the most successful artist worldwide.
Yeah.
And so I suppose it does mean that whoever are the biggest artists of the moment will always get their bit on stage. Obviously, Adele won it a couple of years ago and Ed Sheeran won it. He was there, though, wasn't he? He did show
up. Yes, he turned up. He did a performance. Not one of the songs you would have wanted to hear.
And when he played Glastonbury, you said you're not a big fan of his music on record, but you liked his live show. You thought that was really good. What about his live performance at the Brits? More like his records.
Not even that. It was boring. I guess he did Shape of You last year. That's this big kind of fun performance. So he went for the standing around singing a tedious ballad this year. which it seems to be what most people went for when they were choosing what to do, which really helped. The performances that stood out were the ones where they weren't just standing around doing nothing.
Other than the award winners and the performances and all of that nonsense, you mentioned that Jack Whitehall was hosting this year. Mm-hmm. Because The Brits is an ITV1 television programme, and ITV is the proud home of British mediocrity, they always have pretty mediocre TV presenters or comedians hosting. So, I mean, Anton Deck has...
They've done it a lot.
...hosted it for a number of years.
James Corden did 4 years in a row.
James Corden did it for 4 years in a row. And you sort of sense that he then built his ridiculously successful career as an American chat show host on the back of that. Although at least it sent him over to the other side of the Atlantic. So it did serve a function in that regard. But Jack Whitehall... is a comedian who I first came across at the Edinburgh Fringe. I thought he was terrible. I sort of warmed to him because of Fresh Meat.
Yeah.
He's actually quite good on Fresh Meat, even though he's clearly just playing himself. It's not that he's a good actor. He's just good at playing himself. And then a few weeks ago, for some reason, I don't know what I had done on Facebook to make Facebook's algorithm think that I would want to watch a bit of Jack Whitehall stand-up. But about four videos appeared in my feed of Jack Whitehall doing stand-up. So I thought, I wonder if he's improved. So I watched one. And he was still terrible.
Yeah.
So what was he like as host of the Brit Awards 2018?
He was fine. He did it and it was fine.
So nondescript.
I wouldn't say it was one of the all-time classics, but he didn't drive it into the wall.
I believe that Dermot O'Leary and that Emma Willis presented an award, them having presented the whole show last year.
Yes.
And I suppose bringing us back to where we started to wrap up with the gender diversity debate, they did reference the fact that last year they had a man and a woman hosting, this year back to just a man.
Yes.
And although there have been years back in the dim and distant past when Davina McCall was a big star and she did host it a few years. Although, generally speaking, it tends to be hosted more by a bloke than a woman. And they were basically saying they thought it worked quite well having a man and a woman paired up last year. Why not repeat that this year?
Yes, it was hard to tell. I assume that wasn't scripted because it seemed... Although Jack Whitehall did do a dig at himself for being the white male host later, it didn't seem like that was scripted. They seemed slightly genuinely annoyed. And but like you say, mostly when women have presented the Brits, they've been as more of a sidekick to a man. Solo women have presented it, but maybe like three or four times.
Yeah, so Davina McCall and Kat Deely.
Yeah.
Presumably at the peak of CDUK-dom.
Yeah.
But yes, over the years, more men than women have hosted. I still sometimes ponder about what it would have been like if, at the peak of pop world being the big music show on television, they'd had Sam and Amstel and Makita Oliver host it. I think that would have gone down as one of the...
They could still do that.
They could bring them back together.
That would be...
The problem with that is...
to do next year.
I would love that. A, I don't think Sam and Amstel would want to do it because he sort of put that all behind him. And for certain, the BPI and Brits and MasterCard wouldn't want him to do it. But that would actually make me tune in. In fact, if someone invited me and he was hosting, I would not only would I tune in, I would actually schleck over to Greenwich and watch the thing live if they had those two back on stage hosting it. Anyway, have you got anything else to say about the Brit Awards 2018?
I think my highlight was discovering that Elton John can't pronounce Ed Sheeran's name. When, as we said, Ed Sheeran got the big Well Done for Being You award, Elton wasn't there, but he sent in a video. See, until earlier this month, Ed Sheeran was signed to Elton John's management company. So they've clearly had a close relationship over the years.
And it was an amicable parting of company.
Yes.
Basically, the guy who actually manages Ed Sheeran, who used to be part of Elton John's Rocket Music, has taken his business and spun it off as a separate thing. So it's not that they've had a big fallout.
No.
They are still, in theory, great mates.
Apparently. But Elton was so very clearly reading off cue cards, like squinting at cue cards, and then talked about his great friend Ed Sheeran. I don't know who that is.
Perhaps he was trying to be funny.
I don't think he was.
Or perhaps that's how you pronounce it. And the rest of us have just got it wrong all these years.
I think Elton John doesn't really know who he is.
He is in Vegas at the moment, isn't he? So maybe he's got...
I'm not sure that proves anything.
...other things on his mind than remembering Ed's surname.
There was also one more thing. The Gorillaz acceptance. That was some good old award ceremony chaos of the sort they've tried to beat out of the Brits. But Damon Albarn came on and gave a very drunk acceptance speech about Brexit, I think. And then they went to cut back to Jack Whitehall. But then people who aren't in Gorillaz started giving acceptance speeches. And they had to wait until they'd all finished. And that was good.
Well, those Damon's original experiences of the Brits and the sort of Blur heyday were the era where stuff like that quite often happened at the Brits. When you were saying that more men than women won awards, were you counting gorillas as male?
I was, although two women did give acceptance speeches, but they're not officially members of gorillas.
I mean, so the cartoons are all male, aren't they? But then they're cartoons.
It was Little Sims and Jenny Beth, who are touring with gorillas. I don't think that gives them necessarily the right to give an acceptance speech at the Brits.
But they
did anyway.
Well, well done them.
They turned the lights off on the stage at one point. They carried on.
Well done to them. And I think this is turning into an entire edition of Setlist just dedicated to the Brit Awards. I assume most of our listeners fall into two camps. Camp A, they watched it or were there, and they don't need you to tell them what happened. Camp B, they couldn't care less about the Brits, so perhaps we should wrap up our Brits.
Well, there you go. Set this podcast, satisfying no one since, I don't know, whenever it was we started doing this. Still to come, the future of Toni Basil's legal battle over her hit Mickey, plus some news in brief. But now, Amazon Tickets is shutting down less than a year and a half after it arrived, making some pretty bold claims about how it was going to revolutionise the entire live industry. So Amazon Tickets launched in 2016, claiming it was set to become the world's premier destination for purchasing tickets, with an aim to disrupt the entire live entertainment experience, and was going to upend an industry that has not fundamentally changed since the 1970s. Did it succeed? No, it did not!
Which in some ways is a shame, because although obviously Amazon is a big evil web giant who just wants to take over the entire world, at the same time, it was interesting Amazon launching into ticketing, because we've talked about this on the podcast before. It's really hard entering the ticketing market.
Yes.
Because basically the market is sewn up, particularly at the upper end, the arena shows, the stadium shows, sewn up by a very small number of big players who generally have privileged access to tickets through their relationships with the promoters. In the case of Ticketmaster, they're in common ownership with many of the promoters and venues. And the sort of the legacy ticketing companies, although often their platforms aren't as consumer friendly, the data they provide the promoters isn't necessarily as good as the startups. But what they can do is advance money and give the promoters kickbacks for giving them the vast majority, or sometimes nearly 100% of the ticket allocation. So it's really hard for startups to enter this market, or indeed existing big players. I think it was Tesco, certainly one of the supermarkets, had a go at trying to launch into ticketing a few years ago. But when Amazon said, OK, we're going to do ticketing, it's like, well, if anyone can enter this market, surely Amazon, which A, has a lot of money, so if it wants to start advancing cash and giving kickbacks, it can afford to do that if it wants to. And Amazon is well known for winning over a market by basically loss leading for several years until everyone else is out of business and then taking over. And of course, you know, Amazon is sitting on a huge existing customer base, many of whom buy music products from Amazon. So Amazon knows who's been buying CDs all these years. And although Amazon MP3 was never particularly big compared to iTunes, they are in digital music and obviously they're in streaming. So it was like, perhaps Amazon is the one company that could make this happen. Also, there was talk about Amazon more closely aligning all the different bits of their business that's involved in music. So having CDs and downloads and streams and tickets, and also they're in merch in America as well. Having all of that much more closely aligned, so you'll be able to go into Amazon, pick an artist and see all of that. So there was a logic to what they were saying. And to an extent, we did think, well, if anyone can do it, Amazon can probably do it. But apparently not.
No. Well, yeah, seemingly this is all as a result of Amazon discovering what all ticketing startups quickly discover, is that if you can't do business with Live Nation, then you can't really do business at all. And last year, they abandoned plans to launch Amazon Tickets in the US, because actually it launched in the UK. That's where it's based. And that's where it's now shutting down. And the reason they decided not to go into the US market was because they couldn't agree a deal with Ticketmaster, which is obviously owned by Live Nation.
Yeah, they quickly realised that if Ticketmaster is dominant in the UK market, it's really dominant in the American market, particularly at the arena level. So their solution to that was, well, we'll do a deal with Ticketmaster. But as you say, this is all rumour, isn't it? But the rumour was there was a deal on the table. But basically, Ticketmaster said to Amazon, yeah, we'll give you all the tickets we can't sell.
Oh, yeah. And you can sell them at a discount. Whereas Amazon wanted to sell them at a premium to their prime customers.
So they were looking for the best seats in the house. And Ticketmaster, I assume, said, we have our own VIP premium level system. We don't need help there. We need help with all these sort of cheap tickets that we can't sell. So anyway, they didn't manage to do a deal with Ticketmaster in America. So then the news late last year was, despite Amazon having launched ticketing in the UK and declared global ambitions for that, they had now bailed on America. So the question was, well, will they carry on in the UK? Will they experiment with elsewhere in Europe or Asia or wherever? But last week, an email went out from Amazon Tickets in the UK to the promoters that they have been working with, basically saying, we're shutting down, and although we will fulfil any tickets we have sold as of this point, the ticket allocation we're sitting on, we're not interested in that. They're literally shutting down straight away, as far as I can see, and sending the unsold tickets back.
Yeah, so they've sold tickets for shows up until 2019 at this stage, so that will keep the business running in a certain capacity up until all those shows have happened. But other than that, yeah, nothing. They're returning all the tickets they're sitting on and getting out of that business straight away.
So it seems Amazon's grand ambitions to be a key player in ticketing, both in the UK and in the US and globally, is at an end.
Except there are rumours that they're now going to do something else ticket-based with their Echo devices and the Alexa voice-controlled system. Whether that's their own ticketing business or doing stuff with other people, not really clear.
Yeah, so the rumour is that back in the States, Amazon have called in some promoters from the live sector over there to basically say, yeah, our original play on ticketing, that didn't work, we're getting rid of that. But we have got an idea around the Alexa device. So I don't know if that's, hey, Alexa, I want to go to a gig tonight. Recommend something and sell the tickets. I don't know. So it might be that a new play is coming. As you say, whether or not that is Amazon actually being a ticketing agent or whether that's them having a platform via which other ticketing agents like Ticketmaster can sell their tickets through the Amazon platform, we don't know. But that was the interesting rumour that over here, Amazon's out of ticketing. Oh, look, over here, they're talking about getting into ticketing. I mean, that could just be the classic big company thing where you've got two sides of the business that don't talk to each other.
Yeah.
I experienced that myself when we published the Dissecting Digital Dollar book. We did that through Amazon. We used Amazon's publishing service, which is called CreateSpace, in order to do that. Once I'd set up the book for print on demand, it then said, do you want to publish this on the Kindle? It's like, okay, I'll find out more about that. So you click a button. It then sends you through to the Kindle website. This is all Amazon. Owned both of these, but different website. And then when I opened up the Kindle website, it said, oh, we now do print-on-demand books. You don't have to use CreateSpace anymore. And it's like, well, hang on a second. A, I wish I'd known that because CreateSpace was a nightmare to work with. But B, now you've got two competing businesses both offering the same service. That's a bit confusing. And there was basically a page on the Kindle website saying why we're better than CreateSpace. So, you know, within the Amazon group, you can have two different bits of the business who are saying completely different things or competing with each other. So who knows what's going on? But for at least the next few months, it seems that Amazon, other than fulfilling tickets that it's already sold, will no longer be trying to steal Ticketmaster's thunder.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. There were various bits of Spotify news last week. One, that as we edge closer to the streaming service's stock market listing, its founders Daniel Ek and Martin Lorentzen are going to still retain control of the company despite it being publicly traded.
As you alluded to a couple of weeks ago, I think obviously a lot of articles being written about Spotify business at the moment in the run-up to its direct listing on Wall Street. And in the tech press and the music press, those articles are basically, Spotify's brilliant, but it's screwing over artists, it's ruining music, blah, blah, blah. Whereas in the business press, they're all really interested in the mechanics behind the listing because it's this weird direct listing rather than a usual initial public offering. So lots of articles speculating about that. And so, yeah, Bloomberg this week were looking at the way that there are different classes of shares within the Spotify business, quite common with tech startups. So that although once it directly lists, anyone can become a shareholder in Spotify. The founders, as shareholders in the business, will have super votes when it comes to making key decisions. So you can have a share in Spotify once it lists, but you won't necessarily have much of a say of where Spotify goes next.
There were also rumours that Spotify is going to get into building its own hardware. I mean, not so much rumours as people reading job adverts on the Spotify Jobs website.
Which actually says that.
Yes.
So that's interesting. We assume that that's potentially Spotify going up against Amazon's Echo and the Google Home and the Apple HomePod. There were also rumours this week that Facebook could be launching devices in that space. So it may well be that by next Christmas, you'll have a ridiculous choice of devices to choose from.
Buy one of each and they can talk to each other.
Ask Alexa which one you should buy, and that's what I would do.
The Irish government could be banning ticket touting.
Yeah, that was the news last week. So about a year ago, two MPs in the Irish Parliament proposed new regulation that almost would have outlawed ticket touting in Ireland. It basically would say that you can't sell tickets without the promoter's approval for profit. So you could resell, but only at face value, which basically is similar to the rule that was passed last year in New South Wales in Australia. So that was proposed about a year ago, and then the government said, oh, we need to review this. So they sort of abandoned those proposals. And then the Irish government did a big review, and they interviewed lots of people. That review is now over. And the reports in the Irish press last week was that these two MPs are now meeting with government. They're looking at that review. They're expected to re-propose what they proposed a year ago, which, as I say, is basically banning the reseller tickets for profit in Ireland. And the rumour is that this time the Irish government will back those proposals rather than saying, no, no, we shouldn't do that, or we need to think about this some more. And if that does happen, well, that means Ireland will become amongst the small list of places where ticket touting is actually outlawed, although, of course, the devil is in the detail, and it remains to be seen exactly what that means and how it works.
So you can read more about all of those stories and everything we've discussed this week if you go to the show notes at setlistpodcast.com, where you'll find links to our reports on all of them. And finally this week, a federal court in California has dismissed a trademark infringement claim made by, do we call her a one-hit wonder?
I think she calls herself a one-hit wonder.
Okay, that's fine then. One-hit wonder Toni Basil.
She's also a choreographer, so she has other elements of her career.
I assume she's not been living off that one song since 1980. Maybe she has.
But what a song!
Well, yeah, it's a classic, isn't it?
We're talking about the song Mickey.
Hey Mickey, you're so fine.
That's the one.
You're so fine. You blow my mind.
So,
Hey Mickey.
Exactly.
Sorry, I'll stop.
Be careful or we'll be sued for copyright infringement if you do a full performance of it. So yeah, Toni Basil sued loads of people last year over her big 1980s hit. And it was quite a complicated piece of litigation because lots of people were being sued and there was lots of different elements to the case. So sort of at the heart of it is a dispute over the original record contracts around the track from back in the 1980s. So a company based in America called Razor and Tie claim that they now control the master recording because Toni Basil didn't write the song, so the song copyright's irrelevant. We are talking about the recording copyright. And so this company, Razor and Tie, say that they control the master rights in the track. They have done a number of sync deals with TV programs and with adverts who have then used the track. And then in the lawsuit, there was a dispute over, well, it was one of those where she signed to a British label. And then there was another deal that they got passed to another company. And then that company went bankrupt, I think, or certainly went out of business. And then it got sold and it got bought and it got sold. And they ended up with this company called Razor and Tie. And so there was two allegations about the contracts from the 80s. One was that there was a clause in that contract that gave Toni Basil a veto on sync, which is quite common in record contracts, particularly for more established artists, that they might have a right to consultation or a right to veto. Certainly for advertising sync. I mean, actually, TV sync in most countries goes through the collective licensing system. Yeah. So often there isn't a veto on that. There might be in America because it's a bit different there. But allegation one was there was a veto against sync in the original contract. And now this company, Razor and Tie, were doing all these sync deals without getting her permission. And then there was also some claims that actually the copyright had never been transferred to Razor and Tie. And I think the assumption on that being that therefore it should have gone back to Toni Basil. So that was one part of it, and there were allegations of copyright infringement associated with that. But actually, the element of the case that has been in court recently relates to allegations of trademark infringement against some brands, so Disney, and then some retailers in America who had used the track in their adverts and talked about the fact that they were using the track in their adverts. And so in addition to the contractual dispute and the copyright dispute, there was also a trademark infringement claim against those companies.
Yeah, because they'd used her image and voice, and she was suggesting that that was some sort of implied endorsement on her part. But the defendants, so that, as you say, includes Disney and Forever 21 and Kohl's, countered that there wasn't a case under US trademark law and that Basil was just resorting to making a claim under trademark rather than copyright over a sync because she, as we've said, doesn't control the record.
Depending on your conclusion on the contractual dispute.
As well, it's multi-layered, isn't it?
In this wider litigation. But yeah, It did seem that the trademark claim was quite ambitious, I have to say, although the lawyers working for Tony Basil are still being quite bullish about this because they were given an opportunity by the judge to resubmit an amended lawsuit if they so wish. So her lawyers are still being very adamant about this, and they're particularly honing in on Disney because, of course, Disney is famous for being very litigious in enforcing its Mickey trademark.
Yes.
And there was a whole thing, I think I'm right in saying this. This is my trying to remember what was said when the original lawsuit was filed last year, that Tony Basil has always tried her best to stop her song Mickey from being used by Disney for its Mickey. So her lawyers are still being very bullish, but it did seem very ambitious. And I have to say, even though this is me siding with Big Bag Disney, it did sort of feel like, yeah, really what you're having here is a copyright claim. You're saying that you didn't give permission for this track to be used, but it's really vague as to who controls the copyright. Well, actually, Razor and Tie would say it's not vague at all. They control the copyright. They are allowed to do a sync deal, and therefore you're going for trademark or maybe also the concept of personality rights that sit under American law. And there is an element of this case that would happen at a Californian level rather than a US federal law level.
Yes.
It's a very complicated case. But it did seem like a very ambitious claim, because almost if they had sided with Tony Basil in this case, you sort of sense that that would mean that any artist who didn't have a veto right over sync in a record contract, where the label was the copyright owner as a result of the record contract, the label then did a sync deal, didn't get the artist's approval because contractually they don't need to get the artist's approval and they are the copyright owner. But then the artist then would have a brand new route to basically block the sync by saying, aha, I may not have control of the copyright, I may not have a contractual right to veto, but it's my image, it's my voice, that I'm trademarking that, personality rights, and so therefore I can either block it or demand some money.
Yeah.
Which would be a dangerous precedent,
I would be,
think.
And the judge basically said that it was true that her name and voice had been used in promotional material relating to these syncs. But basically they'd said, we're using Mickey by Tony Basil. And that doesn't imply an endorsement. They were just stating a fact.
Yeah, and as the judge said, it would be really hard to explain to the world that you were using the Tony Basil track Mickey without saying Tony Basil and Mickey. So yeah, he was basically saying, I agree with Disney and these retailers. There doesn't seem to be a case to answer under trademark law here. Although, as we say, he did say to her legal team, you are welcome to resubmit with an amended argument. So it remains to be seen if they do. And there are all the other elements to this case, including the bit that's happening under Californian law. So it's by no means over. And obviously, some people are positioning this as being another artist standing up for their rights, and therefore it being an artist rights case versus, you know, labels and publishers and everyone else who take control of artists' music and songs. So it is an interesting case to follow. Although, as I say, it did feel to me that the trademark element was a bit ambitious from the start. So I tend to think, in my opinion, I mean, I'm not an expert on American trademark law. What do I know? But it did feel like Disney's argument was quite persuasive, shall we say.
Well, that's what they pay them lawyers top dollar for.
That's true. I just bought into the...
fallen into their trap.
That's it.
Yet again.
I apologise.
With that, I think we should just stop this whole proceeding now and leave. And also, we have to now.
Yes.
So that's the end of the show for this week. Please like, rate, review and subscribe to the show wherever you found it or anywhere else. You can choose somewhere else if you like. Competition is a great and important thing. You should also tell at least one and preferably 12 of your friends to listen to it. Yeah, that'll do. Maybe, I mean, more if you like. Just send an email around. I don't know. You can email us. Don't email us to tell us to listen to the show, because we already do. But email us about something else. setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. The show was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. And for more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.